are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
But women in general, to sort of as they're heading towards 30, if you're not married, then you've missed out on some big life goal. And I don't understand. There are so many women who are so accomplished, so intelligent, so successful, so great. And yet as soon as you're heading towards 30, they feel like they must get married, and so many settle because it's just something they have to get done. And it really irritated me. I was like, this is ridiculous. Why do we feel that way?
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting edge school resources, and research informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Maureen Baig, a former teacher turned blogger, TV and radio presenter. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are why Maureen chose to teach at a school within her community, the role teachers have had to play in tackling knife crime, and how Maureen found her voice writing about the unfair standards we hold women to and breaking stereotypes.
Hello everyone, you're listening to Teacher Talk, the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today I am joined by Maureen Baig. Maureen is a former teacher and a blogger and now working on the television. Maureen's got a very interesting history that I'd like to unpick in our podcast, but let's just say hello. Maureen, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So let's go straight into your life as a teacher. You're now on the television and you're doing lots of some incredible work, which we'll unpick. But let's just give her a quick background synopsis of your life. Tottenham girl or Hackney?
Both. So I was born in Hackney in Homerton Hospital, and then I was brought up in Tottenham. I stayed there until I was about 13, 14. So I was in secondary school and then we moved out. But I've always been in North London.
Yeah, you've moved out somewhere where I used to live quite recently. It's considered the countryside there, isn't it?
I agree with neighbours. It's new knowledge for me.
Yeah. So when did the teacher conversation start for you? Let's start there.
When did I realise I wanted to be a teacher?
Yeah.
Gosh, I wanted to be a doctor. That was the actual life ambition. When I was doing my A-levels, I did my A-levels in chemistry, biology, maths and English. But during my A-levels, my brother got very sick and I kind of got to the point where I never wanted to see a hospital again in my life. So that plan went down the drain. I had an offer to do medicine at Queen Mary and I didn't get the grades for it and it was all just not going to plan. Yeah. So I decided to do English at university. I thought, actually, I'm going to do something that I really enjoy. And while I was at university, just to make some extra cash, I started tutoring. My older sister and my older brother were both teachers. So it's something I just knew how to do. I'd watched it my whole life. So it just made sense and I enjoyed doing it. But even then, I think I didn't realize that could be my future career. Then towards the end of university, Pakistan was hit by a devastating flood and I decided to go and teach there for a month. And I taught English at an orphanage in Pakistan. And it just got to the point towards the end of university where I thought, actually, I really like doing this. I like working with young people. I'm good at it. This is what I should do. So it was right towards the end of university when I applied to my PGCE.
And so you went off, is it Gladesmoor or what school did you start your kind of teacher career at?
So I did my NQT and I taught my entire teaching career at Gladesmoor Community School in Tottenham.
Great. So I'm a Haringey, not born and bred. Certainly my teaching career was predominantly in Haringey. It's a tough local authority. How did you find it?
Do you know what? My sister taught at a Catholic grammar school, an all-girls Catholic grammar school. And when she walked in, the girls would all stand up. And she really enjoyed it. And I was offered a job at that school, which was, I mean, it was incredible. It's just not what I wanted to do. I wanted to go, I know it sounds so worthy and cliche, but I wanted to go back and teach where I had been brought up myself. Yeah. I wanted to teach kids with similar backgrounds to me. So I chose to go and teach in Tottenham, and everyone sort of thinks it's, you know, it must have been so challenging, it must have been so difficult, but I think teaching is challenging in general. The kids I taught were incredible. The school I taught at was one of the last remaining outstanding schools in Haringey. They had, I mean, Gladesmore used to be really rough. My sister went to that school and it had like a 13% pass rate. It was rough, but when I went there, I mean, I wouldn't have taught, if I could turn back time, I would do it all over again. I absolutely loved it. I think that school is completely incredible.
I mean, I've got very fond memories of lots of stories from my teaching career as well. And as you quite rightly say, teaching's challenging full stop. And there are pockets of our education system which are really challenging. I know you've had lots of interesting stories. One story I kind of picked up on was your experience of knife crime. And in my career, I've had to deal with that as a school leader on the street also. Can we just talk about some of those challenges that teachers face, particularly in some of our disadvantaged communities? Your thoughts on knife crime in particular, Maureen?
I feel like with the budget cuts, schools obviously don't have enough money to do what they want to do, what they should be doing. We used to have a police officer who was allocated to our school, and he would do things like patrolling the high road after school at the bus stops, just to make sure that there's no trouble when all the kids come out of school from other schools as well. But obviously in recent years, we didn't have enough money to keep him. We were then sharing him with three other schools or two other schools. So we had him sort of once a week. So it became the regular classroom teacher's duty to start patrolling the road. Now, that in itself, I just feel like, and that's no fault of the school, it's like what you have to do to protect the kids, I guess. But when you train to teach maths, you don't train to potentially put your own life at risk by, you know, potentially putting yourself in really dangerous situations. You're patrolling the high road. There are hundreds of teenagers from all sorts of schools and anything can kick off and you're expected to get involved. I feel like there have been a couple of occasions when things have kicked off and I have been there. Mm-hmm. And teachers, including myself, have had to get involved. And luckily nothing, well, it's never led to anything sort of too tragic, but the fact that some children have to make these journeys to school every day, we associate dangerous journeys with something that's going to be somewhere far away in some less developed country. There are kids living in London or in our country right now who make dangerous journeys to school every day when anything could happen to them. I'm not at all justifying or condoning carrying a knife, but there are so many young people who genuinely carry it because they feel unprotected and they feel like if they come across one of these situations where someone's going to try and attack them, what are they going to do? And it's not the right thing to do, but that's what they think. And I just think it's really sad that I just feel like we need to invest in young people, particularly from disadvantaged backgrounds, so much more than we are right now. It's we can't put all the responsibility on classroom teachers. We need to put more provisions in after school so that these kids are protected after school, so that they have somewhere to go, so that we're not looking after their safety. And then we wonder, we want to deal with situations, particularly knife crime. We want to deal with them. You know, what happens after the child already starts carrying a knife? Do we increase stop and search? But that's not dealing with the root cause, and no one's questioning why does a 12-year-old child start carrying a knife in the first place? That's what we need to be dealing with.
And you know, like you said, that, you know, it's not a teacher's mindset to think, as I qualify to be a teacher, I'm going to have to walk out in the streets and break kids. You know, my life as a school leader was pretty much what I was doing full time on some days, rather than in the classroom, patrolling the streets, dispersing children. Mm-hmm. Can I just ask, what was your kind of timestamp of your teaching career? What period did you start and leave?
So I entered teaching straight out of uni, so that would have been, I was 21, it's about 2011 maybe. Okay. And I left 3 years ago,
so quite recently then.
Yes, yeah. So 3 years ago, marks my 3 Septembers ago, I resigned.
Now, when did you start blogging as a teacher? I'm quite interested in that subject, as you'll know.
I didn't even know I was blogging. I was an English teacher. I liked writing. I enjoyed writing. And it was probably about 4 years ago. So it all happened very quickly. So while I was at school, I came to school one morning. It was about 7 o'clock. And the teacher in the classroom next to me, who was also a young Asian female, was crying. And I remember so clearly, she was crying as if somebody had died. And I asked her what the matter was. I was trying to console her, trying to calm her down. And eventually when I did, she said, "My cousin's getting married." And I said, "Well, why are you crying then?" She said, "Because I'm not married," and started crying all over again. And so that morning I had a free period and I wrote what I guess is a blog, like an article. Right. I just wrote something and it was called Why I'm Not Married. It was hardly anything profound. It wasn't anything sort of vague.
Yeah, I had a look at it this morning. So for listeners, tell everyone what the summary of that first blog you ever wrote.
It genuinely was just explaining why I am not married and why this pressure on young women. And obviously that pressure increases according to your culture and et cetera. So for young Asian women, but women in general, to sort of, as they're heading towards 30, if you're not married, then you've missed out on some big life goal. And I don't understand. There are so many women who are so accomplished, so intelligent, so successful, so great. And yet as soon as you're heading towards 30, they feel like they must get married, and so many settle because it's just something they have to get done. And it really irritated me. I was like, why do we, this is ridiculous. Why do we feel that way? So I wrote that and I put it up on the internet for my friends to see, because I thought this is a really good piece of writing. I really liked it. It still is one of my favorite blogs, if not my favorite one. But the next morning, people in Kazakhstan and Uganda were reading it, and the BBC found it and asked me to come and work for them.
Amazing. Now, you've talked about other things in your blog, you know, particularly on topics of beauty and being a Muslim woman. Can you just give our listeners also an interesting insight into some of the things that you have written about? And then I want to come back to how did it influence your life as a teacher in school? Beauty and kind of Muslim, I know they're very broad topics, but roughly what were your interests, Maureen?
I think then during that time, so again, I was sort of in my mid-20s, and it's sort of the age where you're starting to really reflect on your life and what you've done so far. Your early 20s, you're still kind of a child, aren't you? It's just an extension of your teenage years, and it's still all about having fun. But I was at that age where I was like heading towards 30, and I was really thinking about, what do I want to do in this world? Like, what is my purpose? What do I care about? What message do I want to give to the students that I teach and the people? And I realized that my writing was a really powerful tool to get that across. Mm-hmm. So from when I realized how many people had read my first blog and the reach that had, I started writing about other things I cared about. Now, obviously humans are multifaceted. So I care about lots of things, from race and religion to education and young people to literature to beauty and fashion. And so I wrote about all of those things. I think, again, if you mention the word feminism, I think people think it sounds really worthy. But I wrote about things like the way, the sort of unattainable or unfair, unrealistic standards that we hold women to. You can't get it right. So if you wear too much makeup, that's a problem. But if you don't look pretty enough or glamorous enough, that's also a problem. If you know, you're a prude or you're too provocative, or you can either be intelligent or you can be someone who likes to get their nails done. Like, I feel like, particularly, again, bring it back to my students, when we used to have assemblies in schools sort of celebrating women for International Women's Day, and we would be telling women, the girls, to, you know, you shouldn't get your nails done, you shouldn't want to color your hair, you should care about your education. I thought, actually, we've got to kind of move ahead with the times and say, a lot of the majority of the girls in that audience at the time who needed empowerment the most switched off, because we have to understand we're living in a society where these young people are surrounded by images of these super glamorous people every single day, like at their fingertips. They wake up to these images, they sleep to these images. So to tell them that they absolutely shouldn't care about how they look or shouldn't care about being glamorous or about, you know, embracing their femininity,
not realistic.
That's not helpful. What we need to be telling them is that actually you can do all of that. You can, you know, enjoy your makeup. You can get your nails done. You can wear heels. You can do whatever you like. But remember, your priority and the thing that's most important in life is your education. It's the one thing that's not going to fade. It's the one thing that you can carry with you forever. Like, that's the message we should be giving to young people. So I started writing about things like that. And then, yeah, religion obviously plays a massive part in my life. And I think, again, the world, unfortunately, the way it works, when we often just go by sort of first appearances, and we have these preconceived notions of what a Muslim woman should look like and what an intelligent woman should look like. And people will look at me and not necessarily think that I am religious. And obviously it's a subjective word. It depends what you think religious is, but my religion is very important to me. I am a Muslim woman growing up in Britain, born and brought up in Britain, but my faith is an integral part of me. So I wrote about that. I wrote about faith. I wrote about how basically you shouldn't, everything I wrote about was about breaking stereotypes and how you don't have to live your life according to how people expect you to be. You create your own narrative.
How did you know, as you were writing, how was it received in your school if people became aware of what you were writing about, you know, either through corridor conversations or school leaders said XYZ?
So there were, in general, my school was incredibly supportive of what I was doing. You know, I never joined teaching and looked like a typical teacher. I never did things a typical way. Like, I was hugely passionate about building relationships and rapport with my students. And I was hugely passionate about, you know, I mean, they appreciated my passion for change. However, obviously, if I wrote about things like an assembly that had just taken place about celebrating women that I thought was giving out the wrong message, I was pulled into my head teacher's office a couple of times saying I should probably take that down or edit it. I pissed a lot of people off, but equally a lot of people were really like grateful and sort of said, oh my gosh, I'm so glad you said it. I'm so glad somebody said it.
I'd be lying if I, you know, after 2,000 plus blogs, I'd be lying to if I wasn't pulled into an office to take one or two blogs down as well.
It's hard, isn't it? Because even now, it's like, it's part of my truth. It's part of my reality. It's part of my history to share anecdotes and talk about what happened during my time as a teacher. But then equally, you don't want to bring the school in disrepute, or you don't want to irritate the people or piss off the people who...
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Who, you know, you really do appreciate, who did support you, who... So it's tough.
It's a fine line in the world where we seek truth and we want to evolve as a human race and make the world a better place for everyone. It is a very thin line, I know. And I guess with the blogging world now, anyone can do it. There's so many different platforms. We can choose anonymity or we can go transparent.
I sometimes think of that. I sometimes think, like, I half wish that I had done my blog anonymously, and it probably would have, as much as I believe in, you know, standing up for what you believe in and like being proud of what you believe in, I think I probably could have been a lot more like spoken about even more had I chosen to stay anonymous. It's something I do often think about.
Now, when did the television or the radio start knocking on your door?
Was literally it literally the day after my blog?
That first blog?
Yeah.
So when was your kind of first moment in front of the television?
The first thing I was approached to do by the BBC was a series called Muslims Like Us.
Yeah. And so just for people that haven't seen the show, you know, it was BAFTA nominated.
BAFTA winning.
I do apologise. So for people that haven't seen it, can you just give everyone a summary? It's to raise the profile of Muslim and yeah. You tell everyone.
I don't know if you're dodging the question or if you didn't hear me, because I asked you if you've seen it.
I have seen parts of it. I haven't watched the whole
thing. Oh, that's terrible.
So, my homework is to... I didn't hear the question, sorry. I am going to watch it before this podcast goes live.
Right, so I was approached to take part in Muslim Zeitgeist, which essentially was a group of 10 Muslims living in a house together. So it just sounded like a Muslim Big Brother, and I said no almost immediately. I mean, it's fine if people want to take part in something like that, but for me, it's, you know, I was really happy in my job. It's just not something I want to participate in. Obviously, being a Muslim, the way Muslims are often represented on television is not positive anyway. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, so they're going to want a girl who looks like me, and I'm going to enter this house with lots of people who are very opposite to me, and they're going to tell me I can't possibly be Muslim because I've got my hair done and my nails done, and that's not, why would anyone want to be a part of that? Mm-hmm. So I said no for about 3 months, and they were very, very persistent, which now I'm very thankful for. And they said, look, it's not what you think it is. This isn't about arguments over the breakfast table. Mm-hmm. This is literally to have important discussions about what's happening in the world right now, and just to show that we're not like this homogenous group. We're not, all Muslims are not the same, which sounds so obvious, but lots of people actually don't recognize that, just like any other group of people or any other, yeah, like our views vary. Even within our religion, our views vary, vastly vary. So eventually I said yes, and I agreed to take part in the show, and I was very, very proud and pleased of the outcome. And then we won the BAFTA, the Grierson, and the RTS award for it.
Right. What's it like watching yourself back on the telly?
I did the BAFTA speech on the night of the BAFTAs, and then the next morning at 7 o'clock I was in doing a GCSE masterclass in my year 11s.
I watched it just before we came on, and it was a very inspiring speech.
Thank you. And I at that point I sort of thought, you know, that's when things went really crazy, and okay. I was contacted by sort of different production companies and different agencies, and I'd just been promoted in my job. I'd just become deputy head of the year of my job, and I thought, actually, I need to make a decision. I can't continue being Hannah Montana. I need to so that September I resigned.
So, you know, you're doing lots of things. My particular favourite, and you'll probably shout, I don't know if it'll be yours, but I like your working on the coast and all the kind of big outdoor kind of stuff that you're doing around the country. What are your favourites, and what are you currently working on?
Do you know what's really weird? I've sort of become the BBC's like walking specialist, which is so insane, considering, like, I had never walked beyond walking to my Uber or the tube station. But the telly's got this thing where, like, they ask you what you're into and what you're not into, and I sort of said, you know, I'm not into animals, I'm not really
in all those places now.
You say, yeah, and the next thing you know, you've got a commission where you're milking a cow in the middle of the countryside somewhere. And they think it's hilarious. So I definitely really value the work I did on shows like Coast and Walks of Life, mm-hmm. because I got to travel around the UK that I had never done that before. When you think of a holiday, you sort of leave the country. And besides that, I'm in London. I'm very inner city. Mm-hmm. And I did get to see these beautiful places around the UK. Mm-hmm. I think what was my favorite to film was... I really enjoyed filming The Truth About Cosmetic Treatments that came out actually recently. It's still on iPlayer. I think that it's a science program. So it wasn't sort of promoting cosmetic treatments. It wasn't condemning cosmetic treatments. It was just a very factual look of, let's look at what's out there, what works, what doesn't. And because I was sort of in there watching these surgeries and operations get done, that was great. I love it.
I've seen this one. So imagine all the things that you're doing are very, very educational for yourself.
Yeah, completely. And that's a key part of life, isn't it? The fact that you never stop learning. Mm-hmm. You learning isn't something that you just do in school when you're a teenager. Yeah. I think the best people, the most important thing I would want people to remember is that you learn throughout life. Like, there are, even when I look back at some of my blogs and I think, I don't believe that anymore.
Or, yeah, I'm exactly like that.
Yeah, and I don't delete it because I feel like it's really important to, for it to be there, because that's part of my journey. That is what I believed at one point in time when I was, you know, 20 something and sort of. But you do.
Any secret shows that you're plotting that the world doesn't know about yet? Can you give us a coup?
I always plotting. I have just finished filming a series for BBC One, and that's another truth about. Not cosmetic treatments this time. Right. So that should be out towards the end of this year or in January. I'm writing a book.
Yeah, two actually. So tell us what they both are.
So the first one is, I mean, without giving too much away, but I'd sort of say, if you think about Catlin Moran's How to Be a Woman, it's kind of similar in the sense that it explores what it's like. What does the world look like to a 30-year-old British Muslim Pakistani working class woman living in Britain today? What does the world look like? It's everything from my views on feminism to fashion to career to love and relationships. So it's like a series of blogs together, almost, if I could simplify it.
You did either a video or a documentary about a Muslim woman going into the dating scene. Could you give everyone a kind of summary of that journey?
So my first documentary was for BBC One, and it was called Islam, Women and Me. And it was basically looking at the role of women in Islam. Part of it, and it was literally like a 1-minute segment, was a dating sequence where we were sort of looking for, what do Muslim men look for in an ideal wife? And that scene seemed to be like everyone's favorite scene. It's a scene that went viral. It's a scene that you'll now find on YouTube when you type in Islam Women and Me or even my name. Yeah. It was literally like a 1-minute montage of just me going on a quick speed date with some different men. And it's not very representative, is it? We had 3 men who had 3 different views of what they wanted. And it was, again, stating the obvious a little bit, that men want different things.
Absolutely. So how's lockdown been for you, Maureen?
I'm freelance, technically. So at the start of lockdown, I got a phone call and all the projects I was working on 4 projects, and they were all indefinitely postponed or cancelled. And I thought, my career's over. Everything I've built for the last couple of years is gone. What am I going to do? I should have stayed in teaching. And obviously my siblings were still working and they were still getting paid 8% of their salary. And I thought, what am I going to do? And it was a really anxious time. And that topped off with, obviously, and everyone can relate to, but like my brother and my father are both incredibly high risk. They're very vulnerable. So I had still been working to the lead up of to the lockdown before I realized how serious everything was. And I thought, you know, what if it's too late? What if I'm isolating too late and I've already brought the virus back home? So it was really stressful. Mm-hmm. And actually, when I got over it and I thought, there's nothing I can do. There's nothing I can do right now. So I can sit here and worry myself sick about what could go wrong and what's going to happen in the future. But life isn't a straight line. I can't predict what's going to happen in a month's time, in 2 months' time, in 5 months' time. So I've just kind of got to trust the process and have faith in God and just keep moving. And I started cooking with my mother, cooked every day together. I'm the girl who couldn't make toast. I was awful. And I would have probably never learned how to cook had it not been for lockdown. And every day we cooked something, and I made a little recipe book where I wrote down my mom's recipes, and it was wonderful. I got back into sort of exercising and fitness. And when I'm working, obviously it's really difficult to sort of...
You were teaching Greg Rutherford how to cook some Pakistani.
And one of the projects that I've got coming up, that's going to be for socials. It'll be for YouTube. And we start filming actually next week. But obviously, he's the winner of MasterChef, and I only just learned how to cook. And he called me one day. We did the pilgrimage together for BBC Two. So he called me and he said, I really want to make a korma. Can you please teach me? So we were on FaceTime and I was teaching him. And I said, this is really great content. We should record this. So that was the birth of that idea. So
I've taught food tech in my teaching career, and I'm not a curry specialist, but I think a curry, a korma is a basic curry. Am I belittling the curry world here?
Well, I think that what you think is a korma isn't even a korma.
In fact, I recommend following the curry guy. He's a former blogger. He has some great recipes out there. You might be get a few ideas. We're way beyond my 20-minute barrier, Maureen. We're pushing people's commute journeys now. So I'm going to part of my podcast is just fire loads of quick-fire questions at you, see if I can catch you out. And I'm sure as a teacher, you'll find this pretty much a doddle, really. But I'll start off with a big question. And what's the one thing you'd like to see change in education?
I would like to see teachers get the time to spend more time with students and be given the time to do what they actually signed up to do, which is spend time with their students, look after them, nurture them, and transfer a love of learning without focusing so much on other things like paperwork and useless meetings and all the other stuff that comes with it, or give them the time to mark the work adequately. If you just give teachers more time, they will love their jobs and do what they had set out to do in the first place.
Top tips for standing in front of a camera?
I would say pretend the camera's not there, but that is so difficult. Learn your lines, prepare beforehand.
Sure. What's your top tip for freelancers out there?
Always have a few projects going at the same time. You don't want to rely on one source of income.
What's the number one app on your phone that you're always using?
WhatsApp,
okay. What book are you reading?
Right now I'm not reading. I'm writing. What's the last book I read? Girl, Woman, Other.
Okay, favorite curry recipe?
It's got to be a korma.
Okay. I'm no makeup specialist here. What are your kind of makeup recommendations for people listening?
Makeup recommendations. You always want a good foundation, and the best foundation out there is the Huda Beauty Foundation. It makes you look completely airbrushed.
I'll check it out. I might try some. Where would your next pilgrimage be?
I'd love to go again to Saudi Arabia and go to Mecca again.
Okay, now I can see you've got some fantastic nails there. I know Finchley High Street's got loads of great nail bars. Is there anyone you want to particularly shout out to?
What are they called?
Nails USA?
No, it's opposite River Island. I don't even know what they're called, but they are the best.
Okay. Who would you recommend I interview next and why?
Who would I recommend that you interview?
Yeah,
Michelle Obama. She's incredible.
I might be on the waiting list for that one. Where can listeners find out about you online? Blogs.
It's nail art, by the way. Nail art, North Finchley. Where can listeners find out about me? They can read some of my writing, which isn't, you know, some, like I say, it's outdated, but marinebabe.com. I would love for them to listen to my new podcast on BBC Radio 4. Life of Teachers, yes.
So you're on about 9 or 10 episodes now, aren't you? What's next in store?
So we were documenting the first half term back, and that's what we did for the first 8 episodes. And now, if all goes well and we get a second series, then I would like to follow it through the academic year and see, you know, up to the lead up of exams. Are there going to be GCSEs this year? Who knows?
Well, I'll get tweeting it out for you. Final question, Maureen. What would you hope to be your legacy?
I hope people will remember me and remember that they do not need to let people's expectations of them dictate their lives.
Maureen, that's a fantastic way to end. Thank you so much for all your time and the amazing work you do to raise the profile of teaching, but also to bust some stereotypes and make the world a better place. I wish you all the best with your writing. And all your upcoming
I really enjoyed that,
and thank you again for your time. It's been lovely to connect.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.